Good evening, everyone. First of all, please move up. I promise I won't bite unless you ask me to. So, you know, we have a big room, and we've got a great program tonight. So if people will please move up, I think it would be great to have a little more of a sense of community. My name's Ken Mayer. I'm a medical research director at Fenway Community Health, which is the largest provider of services for the LGBT community in New England, and also professor of medicine at Brown University. And I'm here to welcome you this evening as a member of the program board of the American Foundation for AIDS Research, AMFAR. And AMFAR has been a leader since the start of the epidemic in promoting evidence-based research for HIV prevention in all communities. We just have to externalize that discussion more these days, given some of the pushback from some of the people who don't believe in evidence-based research. AMFAR has also been a leader in taking a human rights perspective on what we're doing in the context of research and never just assuming that the research is something in and of itself. Which brings us to this evening. I think Oscar Wilde, as usual, had it right when he described the love that dare not speak its name. You know, the discomfort that governments across the world have had for the past 2.5 decades in creating an environment where the complex world of male sexuality can't be studied, understood, or discussed in a non-judgmental, sex-positive manner has been one of the factors that's potentiated the global spread of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. So I'm very glad that many of you are showing your tenacity in staying tonight so that we can hear from some of the world's experts in elucidating some of the complex issues that we have to think about. When I first started taking care of people in the early 1980s in New England, it was very clear that there were men whose private sexual lives, their sexual repertoire, they were not able to have a reasonable discussion with partners because of the stigma. And I think one of the issues that tonight's discussion and some of the discussions at the conference in the future will hopefully help to demystify that, not just in the U.S. and developed world, but throughout the world, as we'll hear tonight. So without any further ado, I'd like to introduce Kevin Frost, who's the Vice President for Clinical Research at AMFAR. He began his work in AIDS as a treatment activist and helped AMFAR develop its groundbreaking community-based research programs, initially domestically and now internationally, particularly with the important work in the network Treat Asia, which has already made a difference for the lives of people living with HIV throughout Asia and Pacific. Please welcome Kevin Frost. Thank you.
Thanks, Ken. I think Ken's done a great job of setting up why we're here tonight, so I really don't want to waste any time at all. I'm just here to play traffic cop for this program, make sure we try to keep our speakers in line and on time so that you all have a chance to bring up and discuss these issues in more depth. I'm also not going to spend any time introducing them because all of you should have gotten a blue folder when you came in, and if you look inside, you'll have a little bit of a program and some biographies on each of them, which I think does a much better job than I could in introducing these folks for you. So without further ado, let's jump right in and make good use of this time by introducing our first speaker, Gary Dowsett from Australia, who's going to talk about the problematic categorization of MSM. So, Gary?
I expect I get this to work. Good. Okay, so my task tonight is to try and figure out, first of all, where did this term, men who have sex with men, come from, and is it any use to us? I actually think it's not a very useful term, so I should tell you that right up front so you can figure out where I'm coming from. I think we need to recognize that inside 20th century medicine, one of the major problems in the medical sciences of the 20th century has been understanding the homosexual, ever since that term was invented. And understanding the homosexual and how the homosexual male in particular operates in this epidemic has dogged the epidemiology, it has dogged virology, it has dogged every particular science that we've had. Homosexual people are the problem by virtue of being defined as a category in the first place. And I think this underpins the whole way in which HIV set up its pursuit of men who have sex with men, its pursuit of the homosexual in trying to understand the epidemic. So I'm using, for those of you that play in this theory, this is Simon Watney's basic argument in his first book about where the homosexual sits inside the moral panic of AIDS. So the gay man, the homosexual, the man who has sex with man is a problem for every part of the epidemic. If you read even virology and you hear them talk about gay men's bodies in virology textbooks, as Kathy Waldby has analysed in her work, we see that the virologists can't even think about the virus in gay men's bodies without registering something peculiar about these bodies. And it happens the right way through every other category that we work with in the epidemic. WHO in the old days of the Global Program on AIDS actually had a meeting in 1989, to my knowledge, probably the only meeting in the history of the epidemic called by the UN on gay men. I would happily stand corrected, but as far as I know, I think it is the only meeting that has ever happened on gay men and the epidemic. And during that meeting in Geneva, there was actually the debate was going on inside the Global Program on AIDS of what to do with this term, men who had sex with men. Coming from Australia, we were using the word gay men. Indeed, the meeting was called, for all of us from the other countries that were there, a meeting on gay and bisexual men. That was the term that was being used at that meeting at the time. But there was a discussion on this, men who have sex with men. And the acronym MSM was being played around with. And at one point, one of the WHO people said, well, can't we make it MWM, meaning men with men? And I said, was that men who play golf with men? Isn't the whole exercise about the sex? Oh, yes. Now, I think that actually does register again where the homosexual sits inside HIV and AIDS and why men having sex with men has been such a problem to get people to get their heads around and their tongues around. But it wasn't there that that term was decided. That term came around for many, many different places, and we had different versions of it. We had MSM, MWM, and also a few goes at MWHSWM, which is sort of like, you know, GLBTQI, you know, the kind of game that we play with the acronyms in this area. But we seem to have settled on men who have sex with men as the shorthand. Now, some of the reason for the term grows out of the early recognition in the Western epidemics in the 80s that there were men who were having sex with men that were not inside gay communities as we knew them. Excuse me. They turned up in some of the early behavioural studies in the United States, in Britain, in the Netherlands, in Australia. These men who didn't tick the box called gay or didn't tick the box called homosexual, they might have even ticked heterosexual or other if you asked them to tick a category. But then in their behaviours, they were ticking all the things in the questionnaires that put them at risk. And this was puzzling people in some ways. And in many senses, what we tried to do, and for those, there's a number of people in this room who've been doing this kind of research since the beginning of the epidemic as well, we kind of registered this as some sort of identity practice dissonance. That is, there's a practice over here which is clearly homosexual and at risk, and there's an identity, we think we call it that over here, which is clearly at odds with what this practice should be. These men tick heterosexual, but they say they do anal intercourse with men. So this was registered as some kind of dissonance. And we've sat around trying to figure out how to get around that dissonance, not only in Western science and the epidemics, but also increasingly as we've worked on epidemics among men who have sex with men in developing countries. I'm not entirely convinced it's a dissonance in the men themselves. I think it's a kind of dissonance in the science. I think it's our problem, not theirs, that we can't put identity and practice together in a logical way that men who have sex with men actually can do. So I just want to throw that one on the table because that might also engender some debate tonight about how we use and misuse identity inside these particular categories. But maybe also identity itself is a problematic term, and I just want to pull into this very quickly. Sexual identity is a very modern term. It really only starts to be used in the 70s, turning up mainly in psychology literature in the late 70s. If you look at very early gay liberation texts and in the 70s, the word sexual identity doesn't even exist. So it's coming through, probably is stimulated, I think, by both psychology but also sex research and gender studies post-second wave feminism, seeking ways to just define more and more parts of human desire in some sort of way. And identity politics in the 80s, in the social movements, also seemed to take on this term sexual identity as one of the ways to as a call to arms, to mobilise people in a collective effort, but also to put some kind of boundary around the category of, at that time, gay and lesbian. Sexual identity forms some way of seeing who's in the category and who's not. And we can talk about people being in there no matter what they do and how they live their lives. So the category becomes almost reified. We now have a sexual identity, in the West in particular, just like we got a personality sometime during the 40s and the 50s. And no one had a personality in the 19th century. The word didn't exist. But it was framed in the 20th century, and now we've all got one. So now we've all got a sexual identity, and we all have to have one or we can't function. I'm not sure that's true either. But I want to put this up then, that sexual identity is in fact a cultural construct rather than a scientific fact. It's a discursive way of grouping a set of ideas, and as a result it calls itself into existence and becomes reified in a particular kind of way. And I think if we understand that, we can then understand the possibility that people can function sexually without a sexual identity, which is where I want to leave that point. And I just wanted to register as we do that this construct doesn't work well in a lot more communitarian cultures, which is one of the reasons why I think we're finding it very difficult to use identity as a scientific category in many developing countries as we deal with the emerging epidemics among MSM. Okay, so this is what MSM solved for us, a series of problems it fixed. The stigma against gay men right from the earliest days of the epidemic, the gay plague, the terrible anus but the gentle vagina, or whatever, I can't remember what he said now, but you remember the guy who said it. The robust vagina, that's right, and the fragile anus. These kinds of characteristics was very, very much a sort of homophobic or anti-gay kind of way of thinking about the epidemic, and it still runs through the epidemic. You don't need me to tell you that. It's still there strongly throughout the epidemic. And in a sense, gay men were positioned in a very poor way by that kind of discourse, and the MSM category starts to move the emphasis away from gay men, and in particular, it looks at what people do sexually rather than what they see themselves as some kind of either identity statement or as a sense of one's subjectivity. It also, therefore, enables us to take into account the people engaging in these particular risk practices without having to worry about the way they tick the boxes on identity. So it solves a set of problems for us. Except when we went into other developing countries where same-sex eroticism looked nothing like the Western gay communities, we started to realise that non-gay, the gay wasn't going to work there either, and the really important work here would have been the stuff done in Thailand in the late 80s and also Richard Parker's work in Brazil at that time, which revealed to us a way in which sex between men can be quite differently organised culturally than around a concept of either sexual identity or gay. So we needed to have to take into account this other way of understanding how the epidemic might move, and MSM offers a way to get around the category of the problem of gay not working for us to describe wholly the way in which the epidemic was working. So it achieved these things. It focused on sex practices, what you do, and the risk associated with it, rather than sexual identities. It enables us to bypass the stigma associated with gay men particularly. That did not get us around the stigma question for all men who have sex with men, but it temporarily got us around the stigma that was accumulating around gay men in the 80s and the epidemic. And thirdly, it actually obviated the need to decode the identity practice split. We could just let the dissonance lie and not have to worry about it theoretically. We could push it to one side. And I think there are real consequences for the fact that we fail to solve that problem. But this is the problems that it creates. We now have men who have sex with men, and there was an attempt, which I hope we've killed off at this conference, to have men who have sex with men and women. I don't object to anyone having sex with men and women. I just don't like the MSW term. But what we're starting to get, and this is something we faced earlier in Australia, we get men who have sex with men who have sex with women, men who have sex with men and women, and what you end up with is men who have sex, and ultimately you just get men. And that's no use to anybody, because that is not an epidemiological category that makes sense. So there's a problem here with MSM and MSW and the versions we can create to go with us, and it doesn't actually allow us to understand the very different ways in which the virus moves in relation to the sexual practices that men engage in and what kinds of practices they engage in. It also has a tendency to aggregate diverse same-sex desires. So we end up occluding the differences between different cultural patterns of sex between men, and therefore we lose a real richness in those cultural patterns that we can use for prevention. And I think our friends in South Asia have been teaching us really strongly about the incredible diversity across these categories of men who have sex with men that cannot be clustered in any singular way or be touched with one single prevention strategy. It also focuses on practices alone, which got us around one problem earlier on, but it now means we can't understand the relationship between sexual activity and rapid social change. And sexual activity is rapidly changing across the world as a result of post-colonialism and modernisation, urbanisation and globalisation, producing whole new patterns of sexual engagement. Just think of labour migration, for example. It's just one of the huge movements that changes sexual possibilities. MSM doesn't get us anywhere to thinking about how those changes are occurring and what those changes throw up in terms of sexual possibilities. It also fails to understand the quite different axes upon which desire actually works. A modern gay community you might call peer-related sexual attraction. There's a sense in which gay men kind of look like each other, Xerox queens, and they work with desire that looks fairly similar. But there are many, many other ways in which same-sex desire is oriented on different axes, such as the ones that are gender-inflected. The Kotis in South Asia, for example, a feminized masculine form. So gender is in play here in a particular kind of way. Eroticized difference. There's no shadow of a doubt in my mind that things like race or height or age change people's desires and their own desirability. Without difference, without objectification, there may be no desire. And so in understanding the way in which same-sex desire has a myriad number of forms, we need to understand this eroticizing of difference. We need to recognize that same-sex activity is very, very heavily influenced by circumstance and institutions. And I just have to say the word prisons for you to understand that. Think of military camps, think of boarding schools. There's a whole pattern in which same-sex desire gets organized by institutions. They are sexuality institutions in their own right. And that organizes desire in very different kinds of ways. I'm using transactional sex here, but there's many different versions of this, obligational sex, negotiated sex, there's lots of different terms. But sex has a transactional nature, even in marriage. And so we need to understand how that produces patterns of practice and desire. And also, we have problems with what I call, we don't understand peripheral pleasures. And what I mean by peripheral pleasures is men whose lives are organized primarily around families, wives, and what looks like a heterosexual life, who like to have a bit of fun on the side with another man. It's a peripheral pleasure that they want in their sexual repertoire, not necessarily the central pleasure in their repertoire. And that's a very different way of understanding how men might engage in certain practices. It collapses all the transmission dynamics. It is my belief that the epidemic is moving in multiple ways in South Asia. There has been some ways to conceive of MSM as a category that might be a core group that will bridge out via partners to the general population. I don't think that's the way it's going to work at all. I think the virus is going to move like this, backwards and forwards between different categories of MSM who are engaging in different sexual cultures. And that is, if we, the clustering into MSM makes it very hard for us to understand the possibility of oppositional directions in which the virus might move. And I think that's a really crucial fault. And lastly, it invisibilizes gay men and gay culture. Where are gay men anymore? Where are the gay communities who invented safe sex? Where is the gay culture that produced the way in which we do prevention? Gay men disappear in the category of MSM. We even disappear in our own countries because now we're all just MSM. Well, we're not. We're gay men fighting 25 years for the title and the right to be, and the culture that we have created is crucial to our survival. MSM invisibilizes us entirely, and that's not a good thing. And I'm almost there. I have 1 minute and I can talk really fast. Okay, so here's some alternative ways to think about this. Where and when does gay work? This is as a grouping category here. And how can we talk about gay men and gay communities when that's what we're really talking about, when we are talking about gay men and gay communities, not this MSM thing? Let's bring gay men back into the discussion. What about the traditional terms in other cultures? There's a lot of invoking of these traditional terms, but are we simply invoking them or are we producing them anew? What is the kind of discursive act that we've got going on as we reinvent and re-inhabit the terms of indigenous cultures, of local cultures, of other cultures? We need to be thinking much more complicatedly about how we're doing that, but it's one of the ways around the problem. We need to understand with much greater historical and contextualization how same-sex practice comes into being. The whole debate in the United States at the moment among African-American men on the down low is a really, really crucial example of quite complicated historical circumstances producing certain patterns. We've got a lot to learn from those guys engaged in that debate. We need to stop decontextualizing sex acts. Behaviors don't happen in vacuums. They are deeply meaningful practices, and we need to think about the fact that anal sex is not the same in every place it occurs. We have to stop using bareback sex irresponsibly and stupidly as a term to describe unprotected sex. It is not that. It's a much more complicated phenomenon, and not all unprotected sex is unsafe. We have to think very carefully about it. So let's work with practices, culturally contextualized practices and not just behaviours. This means also if we deconstruct these categories and not aggregate, we'll have to have different horses for courses. That is, we won't be able to have a one-size-fits-all prevention program for MSM anywhere. We will need to have to think very carefully about targeting and about difference and how to moderate and modify our prevention approaches around those differences. And lastly, maybe the concept of sexual cultures might get us a little further than the concepts of sexual identity or MSM. If we started to investigate the cultures that produce social change and the cultures that produce sexual opportunity, we might understand and think about those as collective products, we might actually find the resources for prevention that we need. Oh, and one last slide. Did I press it properly?
Oh, yes. My first piece of gratuitous nudity for the conference.
I'd like to offer an opportunity just for questions of clarification. At this point, if there are questions of clarification for Gary, we'll take them now. But for the most part, I'd like to hold questions until the end because I think we'll have a very interesting discussion after you've heard all of the presentations. So are there any questions of clarification? Good. Not seeing any. I'm going to go to our next speaker, Dr. Chris Baer, who's going to be talking and giving us an overview of epidemics in developing countries. So, Chris?
Thanks very much. Are these slides are going to come on? Oh, great. Okay. So first off, I just have to say, as you'll see from my title, that I am going to talk about MSM. And after that enlightening discussion, I think, you know, we all know this is a very problematic category. Nevertheless, it pretty much is the state of where we are, and I look forward to thinking through with our community and people who are interested in prevention for men who have sex with men, getting these terms more articulated and more useful. You'll also note that this is a talk about epidemiology and this is a session about prevention. Epidemiology has been described as the basic science of prevention, and I think that's right. If you want to respond to an epidemic, you really do need to know where it is, where it's going, and hopefully there's still a role for looking globally at the epi. So a couple of things to say up front. First of all, there is unfortunately mounting evidence, and there's been a lot of it presented at this conference, of MSM, of spread in this population, occurring both in developed countries, so something of a resurgent epidemic in the first world, and in developing countries, many of whom have not reported or not studied MSM behaviors until rather recently. And the developing country epidemics that are underway are happening on four continents. MSM epidemics in many of these settings are happening in hidden contexts and contexts of discrimination, of intense stigma, of criminalization across much of the developing world, and of very limited HIV surveillance. So that's the context that we're struggling to understand the epidemiology in and to do prevention in. And I would point out as well that there's data presented here on this worsening and particularly severe epidemic in African-American MSM, and that also appears to be the case in UK black MSM. I'll show you a little data from that. So, global prevalence trends. For those of you who saw the opening talk, I used this same slide, so apologies there, but this is actually not all of the studies. There are a number more that show this same picture. And what you're looking at here is a comparison that we've done of recent published reports of HIV prevalence in MSM across these developing country or low-income settings, although Singapore is not so low-income, and comparing them to the 2006 UNAIDS population prevalence among reproductive age adults. So what you see here very consistently is that these MSM outbreaks, which are consistently high prevalence, are happening against a background, generally speaking, of low reproductive age adult prevalence. And that is particularly striking for a couple of countries like Senegal, Cambodia, and Thailand that are on everybody's short list of success in HIV prevention for sexual transmission populations. That is an important distinction. These epidemics in some ways are quite dislinked from the wider situation. This is data from Bangkok that was presented here by Fritz van Griesenven, and it's a very recent MMWR that's out as well, looking at 2003 and 2005 data from a large, well-done venue daytime sampling population in Bangkok, and just showing indeed that not only are these prevalence rates high, but that this is an ongoing and really quite hot epidemic. These are the same data as the age data I just showed you, done by venue. So this is a process where you count by venue, and you can see that HIV rates doubled at the entertainment venues are mostly bars, at saunas, just about a doubling in a two-year period of men sampled in gay saunas in Thailand, and in parks a substantial increase as well. So this is across all kinds of different networks of MSM. This is a slide from UNAIDS, which I think is very important in this discussion. This compares the highest risk population of women we have in the Americas, which is sex workers. and it's the prevalence from recent studies of female sex workers in red compared to MSM in those same settings in blue. And again, what you see is that despite often what we've heard in the language of this increased female vulnerability, in the Americas, MSM epidemics are substantially more severe. And you can go through the list alphabetically here, but it's true in Argentina, Bolivia, Chile, Colombia, Ecuador, Paraguay, Peru, Uruguay, Venezuela. So this is, in my view, a very consistent story. These are recent data that were presented here by Stephanie Strathdy and her group, and this is looking at HIV prevalence in a number of populations in this new emerging epidemic on the U.S.-Mexico border. Pregnant women, 1%, injection drug users, 6%, MSM, 15.5%, male sex workers, 14.5%. Again, the same dislinked epidemiology. I wanted to just talk briefly about the prevalence trends in the U.S. and particularly among African-American MSM. This is Espinoza's data presented at the retrovirus meetings this year. And what you see is in the 33 states that do name-based reporting, we actually are seeing declines in the U.S., happily, in injection drug users, shown in green, in heterosexuals, shown in pink. And it's important to keep in mind, despite the federal ban on needle and syringe exchange, for those of you who don't know, in the U.S., we actually do have needle and syringe exchange in most U.S. cities, it's mostly been state, city, and local, and NGO, and grassroots efforts. But the IDU epidemic in the states is really declining. The one epidemic that isn't is in MSM, and it actually does not reach, all the others reach strong statistical significance for decline. This is borderline for an increase. But it does have substantial statistical evidence, at least for stability. So again, the MSM epidemic is either stable or worsening, and the others are all declining. This is looking at the data aggregated in another way, just to say that the bulk of overall infections still in the U.S. are due to male-to-male sexual contact. This is the data from black MSM that was done in the U.S. five-city study, including Baltimore, where I live, which tends to be an outlier and was again in this study. And what you can see is if you look at this by racial category, the prevalence in white MSM is about 21%, unacceptably high, but in blacks it's 46%, and the proportion knowing their HIV status was markedly lower. So this is a study that, a recent, well-done study that I would refer everybody to read. Millett et al. Reviewed, did an analysis of all the published data on the black MSM epidemic to try and understand what really were the risks and to explore the principal hypotheses that are out there to describe, you know, to understand why this is happening. And what they did not find is that there's more high-risk sex in this population, that there's more drug use, that they're less gay identified and therefore more likely to engage in risky behavior. What the data did support was that they had more sexually transmitted infections, particularly syphilis, and there really is a syphilis epidemic going on in this population, and that they are less often HIV tested and less likely to know their status. When you think about it, those are the only two things the literature supported, and they both relate to access to health care. And then there's insufficient data to talk about circumcision, but there were two positive studies, one each suggesting that sexual networks may increase risks for these men, and that incarceration, one positive study. So both of those probably need to be replicated. But nevertheless, the data right now can't support those conclusions. This was data presented here by the CDC in a oral presentation looking at the relationship between HIV and methamphetamine use. And I wanted to include it just to underscore, it's a large sample, 11,000 people, that if you look at HIV positive and either HIV negative or untested men and methamphetamine, there's a consistent story across ethnic groups that they all have higher rates if they use methamphetamine. But actually, blacks have the lowest rates of methamphetamine use and the least strong association. So this really cannot simply be attributed to substance use. This is what it looks like for black men in the U.S., the same data compared to the U.K., a recent report there. And you can see that the same ratio essentially holds, although, of course, the epidemic in the U.K. is substantially less severe than the U.S. So what is driving these epidemics? What are the hypotheses? What we've done here is a meta-analysis looking at recent data and looking at odds ratios or where we had them, relative risks. And all of these, I should say, are adjusted odds ratios. So they're controlling for all the other factors. We excluded unadjusted odds ratios. And this, in a way, goes to the heart of this epidemic, and it underscores why, if you think about it, while the categories are important, the fact that unprotected anal intercourse really is the risk here is a critical point. And so that was true in Thailand, it was true in Brazil. One study showing that uncircumcised men were more likely to acquire HIV, and that achieved statistical significance. Frequency of partners, lifetime numbers of partners all play a role, and methamphetamine strongly playing a role as well. So what are the other kinds of drivers? Well, there are some structural risk contexts that are unique to MSM in developing countries, or not necessarily unique, but certainly relate. One is that criminalization and stigma both limit MSM access to prevention, treatment, and care. We sort of know that, but when you really start looking at the data, and I'll show you a little bit more from some other settings, it really is striking. MSM are very understudied, so in terms of trying to do prevention, it's actually hard to know in many settings what's going on with the epidemic. And, for example, they are not included until now, although plans are changing happily in Asia, in sentinel surveillance. And, for example, they're not included in the surveillance in Senegal, a country where same-sex behavior is illegal, and that's really the one well-done African study we have. And, of course, this really terrible rate of access, of coverage for prevention services, fewer than 1 in 10 worldwide is a UNAIDS estimate. So UNAIDS actually has said this very explicitly in the 2006 report. Vulnerability to HIV infection is dramatically increased where sex between men is criminalized. Here, here. Criminalization and homophobia limit access to HIV prevention, information, commodities, treatment, and care. That's from USAID. Delighted that they have staked out that position. MSM behavior is criminalized in more than half of African states. And in a 2006 review of the literature from Caceres et al., there are really no studies on the prevalence of MSM behavior from Africa, and very few behavioral studies more broadly in the population even included questions on MSM. So the general rule in epidemiology is if you don't measure it, you're unlikely to find it. And then faced with legal sanction, male sex were, MSM are excluded or exclude themselves from sexual health and welfare, and I think that certainly is the case. I want to make one particular point about a risk context, because this is coming up, and you're all likely to hear about it in the media, which is that the National AIDS Control Program of India is actually pushing and has lodged a suit to remove the sodomy laws in India to decriminalize sex between men, which until now is up to a 10-year prison sentence, specifically because it is seen that the sodomy laws are a public health risk. And they used a public health evidence, the higher, much higher prevalence, 6% prevalence in MSM compared to much lower in the general population, as a critical part of their argument. And I'll read you the statement from the NACO director. So long as the gay community is forced to go underground, it limits access to them and it makes it difficult for AIDS campaign preventions to reach them. It's not rocket science, it's certainly the case. And the mechanism here appears to be not so much that men have been prosecuted using these sodomy laws, but that the police have targeted MSM outreach workers and transgender outreach workers, and there's been a lot of accounts of police brutality. And, you know, if outreach workers are attacked by the police, then all of our rhetoric about trying to do outreach and prevention, however diverse the cultures are, is really going to be obviously a problem. So we've tried to look at this in a sense as an ecological model to see how this all fits together. And at the core of this, of course, are the individual level behaviors like unprotected receptive anal intercourse, which has to be our target for prevention in these populations, genital ulcers, lack of circumcision, probably, frequency of male partners, and so forth. And then at a more interpersonal relationship level, the STI prevalence, particularly the syphilis prevalence in African Americans, plays an important role. Condom availability, still a problem in a number of places. And then, of course, the actual behaviors that people engage in. At a community level, the lack of prevention services that we consistently see, and this is where the 10% coverage fits, the stigma, access to voluntary counseling and testing that's appropriate and actually tailored to those risks. And ARV access probably plays a role. And then at a national level, government level, rights level, the criminalization, homophobia, human rights context, again, condom availability, not being included in the national surveillance, and the lack of MSM targeted sexual health education pretty much across the globe all contribute to this risk context. And finally, of course, it fits into epidemic stage. And I'm sorry to say, I think the evidence suggests that the epidemic stage is widespread and high rates of transmission everywhere we've looked. So to summarize, MSM continue to be disproportionately affected by HIV in developing countries and in developed countries, particularly in minority men, and data from the U.S. and the U.K. There are outbreaks going on in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, which are occurring consistently against low backgrounds of HIV infection in the general population. And what that says to me is that the rhetoric of targeted interventions is real. These really are the highest risk populations. This is where HIV is happening across, for example, everywhere we've looked in Latin America. And if you look at country priorities and see that MSM are excluded or get a small amount of the funding when they are far and away the most heavily burdened population, that is another form of structural discrimination. And finally, again, we've got to do better with this basic target. If we really can only reach 10% coverage by 2006, we should not be surprised that we're doing so badly, and particularly that young MSM, who really are the most vulnerable and need our support the most, are ending up getting infected at these extraordinarily high rates. Thanks.
Again, I'll just ask if anyone has a question, a point of clarification. Good, not seeing any. Our next speaker, Jonathan Elford, is going to talk about innovative approaches to prevention, particularly the role of the Internet. So, Jonathan?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Kevin, and thank you to ANFOR for inviting me to present a paper at this satellite session. Which I've retitled HIV Risk and Prevention, the Role of the Internet. Now, as we know, it's 10 years since the last AIDS conference was held in Canada, in Vancouver, with this very striking logo by Joe Average. And if you cast your mind back 10 years, for those of you who were there, if you wanted to register for the conference in 1996, you would have filled out a piece of paper, put an envelope, and posted it to the organizers. And if you wanted to submit an abstract, you'd have typed it up, photocopied it 8 times, put it in an envelope, and probably sent it by courier to the organizers, because we all leave these things to the last minute. And if we fast forward 10 years to this year's conference, almost certainly everyone who's here today would have registered online through the Internet. Those of you who submitted abstracts would certainly have done it through the Internet. I think it was almost impossible to do it any other way. And many of us took advantage of being able to look at the conference program online before we came in order to find out which sessions we might be interested in going to. And indeed, some of you may have even found this session online. If you scroll down for Thursday, there we are. And if you click on it, it would have taken you to this page. So the virtual world and the real world become one, because here we all are in session room 11. But what is striking is that just in 10 short years, how the Internet has completely transformed our lives. And it's not just the 20,000 delegates of the 16th International AIDS Conference who have embraced the Internet, but gay men have done so too. These are data from London among gay men whom we survey annually in central London gyms as part of a behavioral surveillance program. And in 2000, we asked for the first time, have you used the Internet to look for a sexual partner in the last 12 months? And just over a quarter of the men said they had. And by last year, 2005, just that had risen to just over half, so a doubling over a 5 or 6 year period. Now, the reason why this is of interest to this group and to this conference is that the Internet has been implicated in several outbreaks of sexually transmitted infections among men who have sex with men in Canada and the USA. And I must point out in this presentation, I'm using the terms men who have sex with men and gay men interchangeably, because I guess I'm just very confused about my identity and their identity. And I apologize for that in advance. But the question that has arisen because of the these outbreaks of STIs, the question that has arisen is seeking sex through the internet contributing to the spread of STIs and HIV over and above that which occurs when men meet partners in offline venues such as bars, clubs, saunas, and parties? In other words, is something different happening, and particularly something additional happening when men meet sexual partners through the internet rather than in bars and clubs and other venues? Now, a number of studies have looked at this over the last few years, and indeed you know that a research area has come of age when somebody conducts a meta-analysis, and one such meta-analysis has been conducted and was published earlier this year in Sexually Transmitted Diseases, and interestingly, it is only available online at the moment. So even academic journals have discovered the many advantages of the internet, putting papers online before they can find space in their print issues. This paper by Adrian Liao and his colleagues from CDC in Atlanta, they conducted a meta-analytic examination of online sex-seeking and sexual risk behavior among men who have sex with men. And for this meta-analysis, they searched electronic databases and identified 22 studies published between 2000 and 2005 which examined online sex-seeking and sexual risk behavior among men who have sex with men. And these 22 studies were conducted in the USA, the UK, the Netherlands, and Sweden. So you can see it's quite focused in terms of the number of countries. Now, they asked three questions. The first question was, what percentage of men have used the internet to look for sexual partners? And the answer to that question depends on where you look and whom you ask. There were 11 studies that recruited men offline. In other words, these were studies that were conducted in clinics, STI clinics, HIV clinics, or in gay venues, bars, clubs, gyms, etc. And the men usually would fill out a questionnaire in that setting, and one of the questions was, have you used the internet to look for sex? And in those studies, the weighted average was 40%. So when they pooled the data from 11 studies, 40% of men said they had used the internet to look for sex, usually in the last 12 months, with a range of 23 to 57% across the studies. There were further 9 studies that recruited men online, usually in chat rooms, and the men were also surveyed, or they clicked onto a questionnaire while they were in the chat room. And the average there was 85%, which is not surprising because most of the men were in those rooms to meet sexual partners. Indeed, it's surprising it's not 100%, and I can only assume that the other 15% were the researchers who were actually asking the questions. But the range here was from 64 to 99%. Now, it's the figure of 40% that is much more believable because that is based upon what we call offline samples, but it shows that about half the men in those samples said they use the internet to look for sexual partners. Now, what is striking, what is important about many of these studies is that in large towns and cities, most gay men who look for sex through the internet also look for and meet casual partners in bars, clubs, and other offline venues. And this is a really important point because we've created a new category, not just MSM or gay men, we've created a new category, internet sex seekers, men who use the internet to look for sex, and have constructed it as though they are a discrete group who are almost like a new group emerging. In fact, in large towns and cities, it's not a new group, it's the same men. They're men who go to bars and clubs and also look for partners online. There are some men who only look for sex through the internet, but in large urban areas, they are a minority. Now, of course, this will be different in rural areas or maybe in small towns. But we're talking here about studies conducted in London, San Francisco, New York. And it seems that for many men in those cities, they have added the internet to their repertoire, if you wish, or their range of choices, rather than the internet replacing the bars and clubs. And certainly those of you who know London, if you go to Soho, which is the sort of the gay village, there's no evidence that the bars and clubs are closing there. On the contrary, they seem to be busier than ever, especially this year when we've had such a good summer. Now, the second question was, what percentage of men have actually had sex with partners found online? So the first question was, to what extent have men looked for sex? The second question is, to what extent have they actually had sex with somebody they met online? And again, the answer just depended on where you looked. For the offline studies, the weighted average was 30%. So 40% of the sample said they'd looked for sex online, and 30% of the sample said they'd actually met a sexual partner. In other words, the majority said they had looked and found. And for the online studies, the average was 82%. 85% said they had looked and 82% had found. So the majority of men who said they looked for sex said they also found a sexual partner. So the internet delivers, and not just books and CDs. And the third question, which is the key question, was, is the prevalence of sexual risk behavior higher among men who use the internet to look for sex than among men who do not, because this was a differential that had appeared in a number of studies. Now, there were 8 studies that looked at this, and in the studies they compared men who said they looked for sex with the internet with men who said they did not. And 6 of the studies found that the men who used the internet to look for sex were more likely to report high-risk sexual behavior than men who did not look for sex with the internet. And the other 2 studies, they found no association, but none of them found a negative association. And the combined odds ratio was 1.7. In other words, on average, the men who looked for sex with the internet were twice as likely to report high-risk sexual behavior as a group than men who did not look for sex with the internet. And that was a highly significant finding. Now, what does this look like in an individual study? These are data from London, which were included in the meta-analysis. These are data for HIV-negative men who report what we call unsafe sex, that is, unprotected intercourse with a casual partner of unknown or discordant HIV status, which presents a risk for HIV transmission. We surveyed nearly 400 HIV-negative men in a testing clinic, and the red bar are those men who use the internet to look for sex, and 25% reported unsafe sex, compared with 12% of men who did not use the internet to look for sex. So a 2-fold difference. And we saw a similar differential for HIV-negative men whom we surveyed in the gyms, 19% and 8%. And when we looked at HIV-positive men reporting what we call unsafe sex, we saw a similar differential. We also examined or considered HIV-positive men who reported serosorting. That is, they only had unprotected sex with a seroconcordant casual partner with another HIV-positive man. We surveyed 500 HIV-positive men in a treatment clinic. 28% who used the internet reported serosorting, compared with 5% who did not use the internet. And we saw a similar, if not even bigger, differential for the men surveyed in the gyms. Now, this association has raised more questions than it's been able to answer. But 2 hypotheses have been put forward to explain the association. One is the self-selection hypothesis, which is that high-risk men may gravitate to the internet. They found the internet. And the other hypothesis, the accentuation hypothesis, suggests that seeking sex through the internet may in some way amplify risk behavior, that the internet allows us to create networks, in this case sexual networks, which in some way amplify risk in a way that would not happen so easily in bars and clubs. Now, Liao and colleagues said it's not clear which hypothesis prevails, but it's probably a bit of each. But our London study has given us some clues on this. For HIV-positive gay men in London, HIV-positive gay men were more likely to meet online rather than offline other HIV-positive men for unprotected sex, that is what we would call serosorting. And they said in qualitative interviews that compared with offline venues such as bars and clubs, the internet provides a relatively safe environment where HIV-positive men can disclose their status. It was a safer and less stigmatizing environment. And as a consequence, by serosorting on the internet, HIV-positive men could establish concordance in a way that could not happen so easily offline. In other words, there is evidence of accentuation. The internet was allowing positive men to disclose their status and to identify one another and to meet one another more easily than they could in bars and clubs. So there was evidence there of accentuation. Now, while serosorting can reduce the risk of HIV transmission between sexual partners, it still carries an STI risk. So our data suggests that serosorting on the internet does contribute to STI transmission among HIV-positive gay men in London. And certainly we've seen an increase in London and in other cities in STIs such as syphilis, HIV, and hepatitis C among HIV-positive gay men. When we looked at HIV transmission risk, however, both HIV-positive and negative men who look for sex through the internet were more likely to report unsafe sex than other men as a group. But when we asked them, where did you meet your partners, they were just as likely to meet their partners offline as online. And that was because, as you remember I said earlier, most men who look for sex through the internet, that is online, also looked for and met casual partners offline. They were mixing and matching. And so they were just as likely to report unsafe sex with a casual partner they met in a bar or club as on the internet. And there was no evidence that the internet per se created a risk for HIV transmission. But on the contrary, our data suggests that in relation to HIV transmission, high-risk men gravitate towards the internet rather than the internet itself accentuating risk. Now, interestingly, there was a poster from San Francisco yesterday which came up with similar findings. So it's interesting, it's now being replicated in another large city. Now, what are the implications of this for HIV and STI prevention? Well, there's no doubt that a considerable percentage of men use the internet to look for sexual partners, perhaps 50% now in major cities. And those who do have a riskier sexual behavior profile than other men, whether that's a result of self-selection or accentuation. And so the internet offers enormous potential for HIV and STI prevention. It becomes an additional venue, not necessarily to replace offline interventions, but certainly as a new venue. And these are data from London, which just show that when we asked men online what their attitudes were to online HIV STI prevention, they were generally very positive about it, with maybe 80% endorsing or supporting online prevention. And here at the conference, just today, over the last few days, a number of interventions have been presented, such as gaycruise.com from the Netherlands, the MINT study from the United States, the DIPEX website on HIV from the UK, and mysexycity.com, also from the USA. And there was a poster discussion session at lunchtime today, which was focusing solely on internet-based interventions, mostly among men have sex with men. So a number of interventions have been formulated and have been trialed. Now, most of them have focused on primary prevention, that is preventing the transmission of HIV and STI to uninfected men. But I think, and this has been neglected until now, we should also be considering the potential of the internet for secondary prevention among people living with HIV, that is improving their or supporting their emotional and physical health and improving their physical and emotional health, particularly since we know a lot of people with HIV use the internet already to get information, and so they are already, if you wish, a captive audience. The unanswered questions, which I will go through very quickly, are first of all, what is the effectiveness of internet-based HIV prevention initiatives? Up until now, we have relatively little information about the effectiveness of interventions, partially because they're still at an experimental stage. Another question to consider is what lessons can be learned from other internet interventions? For example, cognitive behavioral therapy is available online for depression. Could those models be used in for HIV interventions? And finally, and touching upon what the previous speaker was talking about, what is the potential, how are MSM in Africa, Asia, and Latin America using the internet, and how can it be developed further? So in conclusion, it's quite clear over the last 6 years that most research has focused on the internet and sexual risk and describing the association. And it seems likely that over the next 12 years, there'll be increasing research into the effectiveness of online interventions. So if AMFAR is so kind as to organize a satellite session of the 19th International AIDS Conference at an as yet unannounced destination, then I think we will be able to look back over the 6 years that will have passed and be able to perhaps have a more informed and a more insightful view into the effectiveness of interventions. But at the moment, I think we have to be a little bit patient and wait until that time comes to pass. Thank you very much.
Do I need to ask if there are any questions of clarification? Oh, well, there is one. Hold on, microphone one. He's asking, how did you define safe sex? Hold on, your mic's not on, Jonathan. I'm going to go over there and slap the sound man around. I'm just kidding.
It's working. It's working, Kevin.
We define unsafe sex as unprotected anal intercourse with a partner of unknown or discordant HIV status. So that presented a risk for HIV transmission and possibly STI transmission. But if the partner was of unknown or discordant HIV status, there was a possibility of HIV transmission.
You have a question of clarification? Go ahead.
Ethnic minority men within that population, because I think it'd be interesting to see if people who are living less openly might be more inclined to use the internet more or less.
Okay. In these samples, 90% of the men describe themselves as white. Only 10% describe themselves as ethnic minority. So those numbers are very small. But there is evidence that men who are less open about their sexuality are more likely to use the internet to meet sexual partners than other men. So by inference, and by you may surmise that therefore ethnic minority men who are less open would be more likely to use the internet.
Thanks, Jonathan. Our next speaker, Grant Colfax, is going to talk about drugs, mental health, and HIV.
Thank you. Thank you for the great turnout at the end of a long and exhilarating but tiring conference. So I'm going to talk about drugs, mental health, and HIV risk among MSM substance users. What's new? I'll update the epidemiology of substance use among MSM. I'm going to focus mainly on U.S. MSM, and I have to use the term MSM here because the studies defined the participants as MSM, although I will say that most of these men are gay-identified in all the studies I'm going to talk about. I'll describe the associations between substance use and HIV risk, and also briefly discuss other mental health disorders and HIV risk, really focusing mainly on depression. I think it's also important to describe the current and potential future prevention interventions among substance users with the questions of, do they reduce HIV risk, and do they influence other mental health comorbidities? Substance use is common among MSM. If you look at population-based studies in the U.S. as well as Europe, you generally find that substance use among MSM is 2 to 3 times more prevalent in the MSM population compared to heterosexual males. If you then look at within HIV-positive populations, substance use is about 2 to 3 times more prevalent among HIV-positive MSM compared to negative MSM. It's very important, however, to realize that only about a quarter of MSM substance users are frequent users, generally defined as weekly or more use. I think we need to think about that because with the media attention, especially paid to the methamphetamine epidemic, you would think that every HIV negative or positive MSM is a meth dependent. And even with the MSM who use meth, most of them are infrequent users. And that really is important in terms of how we tailor interventions for these different populations of MSM substance users. Mental health disorders, in addition to substance use, which is a mental health disorder for many of these people, other mental health disorders are particularly prevalent among MSM. This population-based GUM study done by Ron Stahl et al. Found that almost a quarter of substance-using MSM had symptoms of depression and very high rates of distress as well. So if we look through the literature for the past 25 years, there is very strong evidence that substance use increases HIV risk. Many studies over this time have shown that substance use is associated with increased numbers of sex partners, increased risk of engaging in unprotected sex, is associated with increased risk of sexually transmitted diseases, and increased risk of HIV infection, HIV seroconversion. Many studies have found robust associations for methamphetamine use, poppers, cocaine, and heavy alcohol use. In the literature, there's a question about why are there these associations? Is it something about substance users? Is it their personality characteristics that make them risky, and therefore the substance use isn't on the causal pathway to risk? Or is there really something about when you use substances, no matter how you are in other ways, you're going to be more risky? So it's similar, people who use substances are probably less likely to wear seatbelts, but we would never think not wearing a seatbelt would lead to unsafe sex, at least most of the time. So we looked we did a within-person analysis from the Explore study. The Explore study was an intervention study of over 4,000 MSM in the U.S., and we did a within-person analysis to try to answer the question, does substance use predict high-risk sexual behavior? We did something called a multivariate conditional logistic regression analysis, and the advantage here is that each person serves as his own control. So you're controlling for the intrapersonal characteristics of the person. And we examined up to the last 3 sexual episodes with the most recent 3 sex partners. We looked at substances used, that was our primary predictor variable, and we looked at sexual behavior, high-risk sexual behavior defined as having unprotected anal sex with an unknown or HIV-positive partner. These were all HIV-negative men. In our analysis, we found that heavy drinking, 6 or more drinks during the sexual episode, was associated with an over doubling of risk, 2.4 odds ratio, and use of poppers, sniff cocaine, or meth use during sex was also independently associated with high-risk behavior. Note that we were also able to adjust for multiple other factors in addition to the participant, including location of sex and different aspects about the partner himself, such as attractiveness of partner, how long they've known partner, and so forth. So that's really interesting. Substance use within a person is associated with increased risk of unprotected sex. The next analysis that was also done on the Explore study by Beryl Koblin in New York, along with the other co-investigators in the study, was looking at predictors of HIV seroconversion in the Explore study. So we found that indeed drug use during sex was associated with independently with HIV seroconversion with an odds ratio of 1.6. Okay? Interestingly, this is associated with HIV seroconversion after controlling for very well-recognized other behavioral risk factors, such as having unprotected receptive anal intercourse with an HIV-positive partner, URA on the slide, and unprotected receptive anal sex with an unknown serostatus partner. In addition, we looked at the attributable fraction of each predictor contributing to HIV seroconversion. So the attributable fraction takes into account not only the excess risk associated with the predictor variable, but also the prevalence of that predictor variable in the population. Okay, so you can see here that drug use during sex, the attributable fraction towards HIV infections was 29%. Similar to the behavioral risk factors of unprotected sex, and much greater than the gonorrhea risk. Gonorrhea was associated with an odds ratio of 2.5, but the attributable fraction was 4%. That's because even though gonorrhea was associated with high risk, the prevalence of gonorrhea in this population was low. So how can substance use be independently associated with HIV infection? Very likely they're unmeasured behavioral confounders. We did detailed behavioral analyses using a CASI computer-based system, but there are a lot of behaviors that you can't really ask people about in detail among 4,000 men. We know from qualitative interviews and other studies that substance use is associated with more traumatic sex. There could be partner selection variables that we weren't able to measure. If you're a substance user, you just might be more likely to come into contact with somebody who's more likely to be infected. There's biased reporting. If you've had 6 drinks and then you get ready to have sex, I'm not sure you're going to necessarily remember everything that happened and so forth. There's also some interesting speculative hypotheses about the direct biologic effects of substance use on HIV seroconversion. Possible immunosuppression. It's possible certain drugs may change blood flow to the rectal mucosa, therefore increasing risk. Poppers, amyl nitrites are known to increase rectal blood flow to their anal mucosa, perhaps increasing the surface area for HIV infection to occur. So in the same analysis, we looked at the question of whether depression is associated with HIV risk. So this is the same analysis, and we used the modified CESD scale as a predictor of HIV seroconversion. We found something that we did not expect here. We found that people who scored on an intermediate level of depression were more likely to become HIV infected. This was a hazards ratio of 1.9 in that multivariate analysis. And yet people who had more depressive symptoms, higher levels of depression was not associated with an independent risk of becoming HIV infected. It's possible that the people who were in the intermediate level of depression were able to function sexually, were not seeking medical care, while the people down here who were more depressed were either on medication, were seeking treatment, were able to get counseling, or simply not sexually active, as we know people who become heavily depressed become. I don't want to simplify this. I think that in the Explore study, we were not able to control for multiple other mental health factors that are very likely to be associated with risk. And Ron Stahl did a very elegant analysis looking at the number of psychosocial health problems by HIV infection and sexual risk in the gay urban men study. And he found that as you increase your number of psychosocial health problems, including poly drug use, depression score, childhood sexual abuse, and partner violence, in general, you found increases in the prevalence of high-risk sex in the population, as well as HIV prevalence. I think the challenge for us in this day and age for MSM is how do we address these multiple mental health comorbidities in an intervention that we can actually measure the effect in. But at the same time, I think it's important that we realize that MSM substance users who come into treatment decrease their substance use and decrease their sexual risk behavior. And Ron Stahl has done this very well with treatment-seeking meth-dependent MSM in behavioral interventions. He studied a number of different behavioral interventions, including cognitive behavioral therapy and case management, contingency management, which is a voucher reinforcement program for having consecutive meth-negative urines. I can discuss the details, or Steve can discuss the details of these interventions later, but the take-home point is, no matter what the intervention, he found that men at follow-up reported fewer risk behaviors. This is mean number of unprotected inserve anal sex episodes at baseline compared to 12 months. And there was a significant difference between the two, in both study arms, there was a significant difference from baseline to follow-up. Interestingly, Steve and his colleague David Peck also looked at depressive symptoms in these methamphetamine-using MSM, and he found, just as we saw that sexual risk behavior went down, that depressive symptoms actually improved over time. So as measured on the Beck Depression Inventory Scale, as people followed up and stopped their meth use, their depression got better. And this is interesting, so it's suggesting that the meth use in this population, this treatment-seeking population of meth-dependent MSM, that the meth use may be actually causing the depression. And as you take away the meth, the depression symptoms get better. This is counter to a lot of other work that's been done that suggests that depressive people use substances to relieve their depression. So those were behavioral interventions with meth-dependent substance-using MSM. There's another population, the population I talked about before, the guys who are using intermittently. And Project Mix is a CDC-funded study that's looking at specifically at these guys to ask the question, if we intervene from a risk reduction perspective in non-drug treatment settings, can we reduce the sexual risk associated with substance use? This is a very large study, over 1,300 MSM with a lot of racial and ethnic diversity. We've just finished enrolling the study, and we hope to have some results out in about a year and a half. I think there's still a lot of questions about behavioral interventions among MSM substance users. Do they work? We do not know how much behavior reduction you need to see in order to reduce HIV incidence. Most studies, most meta-analyses show behavioral interventions are associated with about a 26% reduction in sexual risk behavior. The big question is that enough to reduce HIV incidence? In many of these studies, we cannot rule out cohort effects. In other words, if you're a meth-dependent person coming in for treatment, would you have were you ready and appropriately prepared to reduce your meth use, and you would have done that even if you hadn't gone into the intervention? There's lots of questions about feasibility. How do we apply intense behavioral interventions in this day of budget cuts and limited public health resources? And behavioral interventions are unlikely to reach all substance users. They may be most acceptable for treatment seekers because those people are, quote unquote, bottomed out and maybe finally ready to change their behavior, and possibly also for the recreational user who hasn't used so many substances that they can't that they cannot learn the complex cognitive behavioral skills we try to give people in these therapies. There are a lot more questions. Will pharmacologic interventions show efficacy in reducing MSM substance use and be associated with sexual risk reduction? I don't think pharmacologic interventions are going to be a magic bullet. I think that they can be an appropriate co-treatment with behavioral interventions. Will treatment of depression and other negative affective states decrease substance use and HIV risk? We still don't know that in this day and age. What is the effect of structural interventions on substance use and HIV risk among MSM? There's a lot going on right now in the gay community in the U.S. as well as internationally. What are the effects of marriage laws, either positive or negative? And in many cases, there's more anti-marriage laws going on in this country. What's the effect of parenting? Many, many, many more gay people are adopting kids. It's less likely probably that you're going to go out to a bar and use drugs. On the other hand, my parents might have used more drugs when they had kids. And then what are the effect of precursor controls? So this is an active area in terms of what's the effect of law enforcement. There's been a lot of attention paid in the U.S. to precursor controls on methamphetamine. What's the effect? Are we going to see a burgeoning of even more of an underground meth supply system? And finally, how do we effectively intervene on the multiple populations of MSM, including non-gay identified persons, MSM of color, and younger and older people? I'll stop there and acknowledge my collaborators. Thank you.
Are there any questions of clarification? At microphone two.
Yeah, one question of clarification. I understand San Francisco is big and methadone users are probably easier to get to. But what about crack? Crack cocaine?
Right. Well, I think that most of the studies that I've looked at, and I think most people would agree that cocaine is associated with a great deal of sexual risk. There was a study done by George Woody in the NIDA collaborative trial that showed that cocaine users who came into behavioral treatment actually decreased their sexual risk behavior as well as their cocaine use. That wasn't limited to MSM. I actually had that slide to show, but because it wasn't MSM specific, I didn't have time to show that.
At microphone one.
Alex Caravaggio, Columbia University. I think that your data on the association between alcohol use and sexual risk behavior is interesting not only in what in its significance but also in the non-significant statistics. If I understood correctly, 6 drinks or more is associated with risk.
Correct.
But not lower levels. So
correct.
Forever people have been saying, oh, don't drink and fuck, right? But here you're saying something different. Can you comment on that?
I just had a conversation with somebody about this earlier. Yeah, I think that it might be in some ways an explanation for the controversy around alcohol use associations with sexual risk in the past. And what we're finding, and I think other people have subsequently reinforced this, that you have to look at event-specific issues and you have to look at the dose response. So it's sort of like, you know, one glass of red wine might be good for your heart, but if you have six, it might kill you. And I think maybe this applies in terms of sexual risk as well. What surprised me was that you could even keep going after 6 drinks. I mean, I think that this does raise the point that if we intervene with alcohol risk, we need to really target the heavy users. At least that's what's suggested here.
One more quick question.
Yes, Chelahoff, University of Michigan. I was trying to kind of wrap my head around how you had the drinkers and then the drug users, and I wanted you to talk a little bit more about polydrug use,
mm-hmm.
you know, and what kinds of issues you were having between those two groups.
Right. So I'm sorry that I went so quickly. So we did look at polydrug. We actually were able to ask the people what drugs specifically did they use during the sexual risk activity. And we looked at other drugs as well, such as ecstasy, GHB, marijuana, and none of those were associated with risk. So it was really the four drugs that I concentrated on.
Thanks, Grant. Our final speaker is Ashok Rakawi from the Humsphar Trust in India, who's going to talk about policy and advocacy addressing stigma and discrimination against MSM in developing countries. So,
I think all of you must be pretty sick and tired of statistics, and more statistics. So we're going to get to some more colorful stuff, diagrams. Anyway, importantly, Gary, I must say that much before you had the gay construction, when I was young, I was looking for the homosexual construction. And looking at Havelock Ellis, Magnus Hirschfeld, going through all those thick tomes, I couldn't find a single definition because it had not been invented until, I think, 1869, of all things by an Austrian clinical psychologist. So please understand that even the word homosexual is so new that in 1989, when I came for my first International AIDS conference, a delegate from the Indian government, the Union Health Ministry, was there present, and he said India would never have an HIV epidemic because we didn't have homosexuals. And of course, when I did go up to him and said, well, I'm here, and he said, and he said, who let you out of the country? So it's a big, big improvement that today in the same country in Canada, the project director of the National AIDS Control Program is even asking for a removal of the sodomy laws. So we are getting somewhere. Now, our problem in India was that if you look at the sacred law, if you look at Buddhist, Brahminical texts, you find a great many definitions of such men, you know, we won't say what men, But such men who seem to be interested in same sex. In fact, some of the Buddhist chronicles even talk about men becoming gay during the new moon and you have to be very careful of such men. They're called Amavasa Pandakas. Very interesting. The Buddha was an interesting guy. Anyway, the important thing is that our job in India as a sort of community-based organizations of gay men as we know them in the Western sense. Guys who are not going to get married to women, guys who are very clear about their identity for same-sex desire, men who will stick and stand up for that identity, who are very rare. And this group of community-based guys did have the job of deconstructing what is called the MSM sector. And here you have this colorful diagram. Professor Lawrence Cohen of Berkeley said, I understand the yellow, but why so much of it is not filled in? Because everybody's on the periphery, if you'll observe. All the groups on top are groups of same-sex loving men whose identities are based around gender, what we call the hijra constructions. And hijras, it would interest this audience to know that the Indian government actually gives transgendered passports under transgender. So there's a male, female, and E for eunuch. So that's something very modern which you Americans and the people in the West don't have. All the groups at the bottom are the ones whose identity is based around behavior. The groups on your right are groups whose vulnerability comes from the fact of their workplace and situations. They could be trucker's boys, they could be masseurs, they could be bar boys, they could be young hunks coming to Bombay to become film stars and having to do a little side work. So you have these men who are vulnerable because of their workplace. And of course, on the other side, you have this strange category called bisexuals. In Humsafar, we even have a category called biosexual. I don't know what that means. But the bisexuals, I mean, we would like to look at such men in prisons and remand homes and men who are situationally homosexual. So this diagram, when it was explained to the government of India, and it took about 8 years to explain that such men existed. Not only that, but today the government of India has put MSM in the core category of population. So that's a huge improvement. In the sense, if a state government, you know, we have a federal system, and if a state government does not fund a group of men having sex with men, it cannot fund any other groups. So that's, again, from 1989, that's a huge advance. Now let us see what could Humsafar do to reach such men. For the simple reason, we didn't know where they were. We ourselves were a group of very, very clearly self-identified, we call ourselves SIH, self-identified homosexuals, not gay. Okay? So such men in Bombay City, how did we go about trying an intervention or prevention program among men having sex with men? What we did was the next, please. Are we stuck? Oh, do I do that? Okay. Yes. We tried out the clinical and the outreach way out. We used the voluntary counseling testing centers, which first started off as a sexually transmitted infection center. And this clinic was the first to be set up in July 1999. And that's from where it started. When the outreach was linked to the clinic, we could get such men in without talking about identity. Identity was not brought in. We said, if you are a same-sex desiring person, a male, you are welcome to come into the clinic. And we shall have specialized services for you because the government health facilities did not provide for anal and oral STIs. Even today, the first question that is asked in a sexually transmitted STI clinic, a public health facilities, aap bahar jaate ho kya, which means, do you go outside? Now, what does that mean? Do you go outside the paradigm of heterosexual marriage? It's very clear that it's what they do outside that is not clear. They could be having sex with men, they could be having sex with women, or they could be having sex with hijras, who are a totally accepted and culturally recognized category. So we started with the clinic. there was the counseling center. And of course, afterwards, our positive people's group was called the Safe Sailors Club. We don't use the word seropositive. It was called the Safe Sailors Club. All these three linkages were through our outreach. Humsafar started with just six sites in Bombay City. Today, we are working on a little more than 200 sex sites in the city. We have 45 odd outreach workers. Each worker mans a beat of approximately 5 to 6 sex sites. And last year, we have distributed around 700,000 condoms in one-on-one sexual contacts. In the sense, no outreach worker is allowed to give boxes of condoms. It's exactly what you need every day that is given to you. Because it is a problem. You cannot hide condoms. Your mother or your wife finds them, you're in trouble. So we also teach you how to hide condoms. Also, at a particular traffic intersections and what are called check nakas, the police check you. They check your identity. And if you're found with a condom, you can be beaten up. So now that's how orthodox the police, the conservative, they are. They wouldn't mind if you're MSM, but you can't carry a condom. So, how was it? Rather complicated diagram. It's a seamless service. The outreach worker, who's also health facilitator, who can take you to a public health facility or bring you into this STI clinic or VCTC, gets you into the clinic. At the same time, we have the community walk-ins. You don't have to be contacted by outreach worker. And through that, you can get into a public health facility. You may feel that if you come into the Humsafar Center, you could be identified as such a man. So you could go into a public health facility where Humsafar health facilitators sit and teach you how to fill in the case papers. We also short-circuit the government machinery by taking you straight to the doctor. That's not really, I mean, I wouldn't confess that in India, but I can do that here. What are the other support services that we offer? We offer simple things like clean, potable drinking water. I mean, that's a problem in cities like Bombay. So care services not just start with opportunistic infection treatment. They start with clean water, how to manage your diets, with simple things you get in the bazaar. And through that, we walk them through mental health professional help. If it needs a three level, there are three levels of counseling. There is a street counselor. There is a counselor. If he can't handle it, it is thrown up into the clinic where he has to have a one-on-one session with the health professional in the clinic. If not, if he needs some sort of diagnosis and if he needs medication, then they're sent into the psychiatric ward of the public hospitals. So there is a holistic look at it. I know it looks complicated, but that's the way we've gone. Over the last 2 years, the government free rollout has started. Humsafar has started enrolling people. It still is a huge problem because transgender are not even allowed to get past the gates of the hospitals. So we have started collaboration with Medicine Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Frontières, who accept transgender, all those who have fallen to the interstices of the government health programs. So that's how we have sort of set up the work. It's a short and sweet overview of Humsafar's work. Prevention, of course, through a huge outreach program that sort of encompasses the whole of Bombay and Greater Bombay. Plus, we have treatment issues. We are linked to the government rollout programs ever since it began. And, of course, we have the Positive People's, the Positive Gay Men's Club, which is not situated in the center itself. The center has a drop-in center. It has a STI clinic. It has archives. It has a library. There are counseling rooms. But the Safe Sailors Club or the Positive Men's Club is not in the Humsafar Center. It's about 10 kilometers away because there are multiple stigmas associated with it. You could be MSM. After that, you could be MSM and married. That's a second stigma, married to a woman. Third is you could be a MSM, you could be married and you could be a sex worker. Fourth is you could be a cross-dresser. Fifth is you could be a depressed or untouchable caste, lower economic status. And sixth, you might be HIV positive. That's the least of the problems. So that's a quick overview of Hamsafar's prevention strategy. Thank you.
Thanks, Ashok. We've had five really extraordinary presentations, and normally we wait to the end to do this, but before everybody runs out, I'd like to take just a minute to thank these extraordinary presenters for doing this. I'd also like to say that at AMFAR, we're very proud to have been able to sponsor this symposium on MSM. One person is more responsible for this than any other, and she's sitting down front, Dr. Judy Auerbach, our Vice President of Public Policy. I want to recognize her for that work. Thanks, Judy. I think if we could bring up the microphones up here.
Just wanted also to thank AMFAR for organizing this and pulling it together. We really, really appreciate it. And it was, I think, delightful to hear the other speakers. So thank you.
Very welcome. Glad we could do it. I want to open it up for questions now. And I know that this diversity of presentation lends itself to probably a lot of questions. So I would urge you to come to the microphone, ask your questions. A couple of ground rules. I am a little bit of a pissy queen. I'm going to ask that you please ask only one question. We've all been in those sessions where people come up with a whole list of questions. I'd ask that you ask only one, and that you obviously introduce yourself and the organization you're with, and that you not give us a speech. I think we've just heard five terrific ones, and so we will limit it to that and just to questions to give our panelists a chance to try to interact and answer some questions. So seeing someone over here, I think we'll start at microphone number two.
Okay, thank you. It is a question for Gary. You spoke about the importance to take in account the context of sexual intercourse. And in the same time today, most of quantitative behavioral surveys just ask people if they are using condom always, often, sometimes, or never. So it's like an image, a picture that you are safe people or unsafe people. Or in fact, people is more or less safe because it's not the same thing in all sexual intercourse. Do you think it is important to have more longitudinal survey, biographic survey, in order to analyze not the people, but sexual intercourse?
I'm not a very good survey researcher. I can't count. But I think one of the things we've had to do in our survey work is come up with categories of asking about sexual behaviours in order to understand how risk is moving. But what we've done in doing that is we lose the context in which sexual practices are encountered. And over the 90s, we've seen increasingly for gay men in particular, the need to have very fine categories of grading and shading in relation to risk reduction, starting with the negotiated safety model in the early 90s, moving through to zero sorting as the latest version of this story, where risk reduction or harm minimisation is the way we've kind of gone in dealing with the ever-changing sexual cultures surrounding gay men. So I think that also brings in the kinds of partners, the zero status of the partners, and the organisation of the sexual practices is within their cultures. Let me give you an example from Ashok's part of the world. If you're a man having sex with a hijra, the hijra is going to be almost always the receptive partner in anal intercourse by virtue of the feminine category that the hijra occupies in a particular kind of way. So that produces a pattern of risk for that population of MSM, if you like, that will work, which doesn't make sense if you decontextualise that inside a survey. You need to understand the relationship between that sexual practice and the culture in which it occurs to understand the nature of risk. The problem is, survey technology is a fairly crude technology. You can only ask so many questions in so much space and time. And our problem is often we leave our research on men's sexual culture inside the surveys and don't amplify the way we understand those sexual cultures. Our time is up. So we never contextualise those cultures adequately, those practices adequately enough in their sexual cultures to really appreciate the nature of risk.
Ashok, did you want to get in there? I thought I saw
yes,
you.
I just wanted to...
Apparently I'm not the only pussy queen here tonight.
I just wanted to say that there's such a paradox going on because the Madras High Court has recognized marriage for inheritance purposes between a hijra and a mare. And yet, same sexes, and there are anti-sodomy laws, you know, for sex between men, knowing full well that this is a marriage between two men, because 80% of the hijras are not castrated. So there is such a paradox in so many Asian countries. Not only that, I would like to inform Gary that there is a very dangerous trafficking in genderized males in Asia. Because, for example, there are no geishas. There's a shortage of geishas in Japan. Mm. So baklas from Indonesia go to Japan as men. You know, their passport says that they're men. And when they go to Tokyo, they become geishas. So you have geishas from Indonesia. And they're all studying Japanese. So the same thing is happening to hijras who go to the Gulf. You know, they go as males. And even though there are Islamic injunctions against men dressing as women, but these men are practicing sex work in the Gulf countries, in the Arab countries, and come back infected. You know, their passports are marked, stamped HIV positive by Arab countries, very against human rights laws. Just wanted to inform you.
Thanks. Microphone one.
Venkatesh Chakravani from Kamsapha Trust, Mumbai, India. Gary mentioned about the problems with the word MSM. So I just want to give one problem from India. Like even Dr. Chris Bayer, when he showed the data from Chennai, it's 4% of HIV prevalence. That was done among, say, men in the slum areas. So predominantly MSM who don't have any identity. But if you look at the data from Mumbai, which are predominantly, the narco serial surveillance sites in Mumbai is from Hamsavar Trust. So the recruitment was, the recruited persons were predominantly Koti or gay identified. So the serial prevalence there is nearly 18%. So if the researchers are not going to mention among which subgroup of MSM they have done the study, then there's going to be a quite different variation, isn't it? So, but we generally the publications say only MSM. So it doesn't mention about which subgroup of MSM the HIV prevalence is or the sexual risk behavior is. So the policymakers also think, okay, MSM is a homogeneous category. And see, the NACO, they are only talking about scaling up of targeted intervention. There's no other efforts to reach out to other group of MSM. For example, this slum man would not be coming maybe to the cruising sites. They may not be reached out by the outreach workers. So maybe the researchers, I'm just thinking whether the researchers, we can just specify in our studies like, in the title, like HIV prevalence among, say, gay-identified MSM or Koti-identified MSM, something like that. I'm just thinking about, I want to know about comments regarding that one. Thank you.
Comment? Not too close, Chris.
So, thanks for your comment, and I very much agree. I would say that this process has begun to be articulated to some degree by the Avahan Foundation, which is this Gates-funded initiative trying to take prevention to scale in India and in the most affected areas in India. It's a very large initiative. We had a consultation about the unanswered research questions for that prevention agenda, and the one that came out on the absolute top was doing, not to coin a pun there, but look at the categories of gender and sexual orientation among Indian men having sex with men, and particularly in the South, where the epidemic is the most severe, and to really work through that, doing qualitative work and bringing in some other investigators. So I think that process has some real funding behind it, which is encouraging in this area.
Microphone two.
Hello, my name is Paul Ahrens. I'm from the Department of Health in Florida in the United States. And my mind is boggled at this conference by the way talk about circumcision has caught fire. It just seems like it's almost like it's taken for granted or it's a given now that all men are going to be circumcised. To me, it's like a double negative, the term, the absence of circumcision. I mean, circumcision is the absence of a foreskin. And so I'm wondering, does anybody think that it seems like a total non-starter to me that suddenly a lot of, a significant number of men are going to go out and get circumcised, and that's going to cut the transmission rate in half? Or is this just talk about newborns? Is that eventually, I mean, it seems like it's going to cross a lot of cultural, have to cross a lot of cultural barriers even to be accepted for infants. Any comments from people?
Love to. Not too close. I want to know why we don't, why we stop at the tip.
Yeah.
We could solve a huge number of problems if we just castrated all the men. I mean, you know, seriously. Look, I agree with you. I've been quite worried by the way in this conference the assumption is that the evidence that will come from the trials will be fine, and in fact rollout and the documents and the working papers and the guidelines for rollout are all being prepared right this minute inside UNAIDS as if this is going to be an unproblematic exercise. The fact of the matter is we have not engaged in the full debate about the consequences of this kind of a public health intervention. It's a classical old rats and drains model of public health, and sometimes they work. But this is a very complicated cultural act that has a long history and many different cultural meanings right across the planet, an act which is undergoing changes as we speak because of the very debate and discussion that we're having about it in relation to HIV, and none of that discussion has taken place inside the United Nations agencies or inside the funding bodies which are supporting these trials, and it is the methodological nature of these trials that they cannot take those issues into account because they can only test the technical fix. And indeed, they talk about it as a technological intervention. This is not a technological intervention. This is a profound cultural mistake, but you know, a profound cultural act which needs to be thought of as that and not just as a technological fix. How do we get this debate going with the technicists who are producing the kind of science is a bit beyond me, but that's the challenge we should be issuing at this point. And almost every one of the methodological arguments can be argued with and discussed, but there is no space or forum to do that place by place, both within the trials, how the trials are set up, how the observational studies have been constructed, what they're finding, before we even move to the problems of rollout at a cultural level, let alone at an institutional or infrastructure level.
Yeah. Gary, I think there's also the religious question. When the news was first flashed in Indian newspapers, there were near riots because there's a Hindu-Muslim question, it's religious. So it was never followed up in any sort of public health discourse in India, even though, I mean, there could be some epidemiological truth in what this business of circumcision. But it just could not be brought to the public table. It could not be discussed in any legislature. It could not be discussed in hospital settings. Even though, for example, diabetic patients are advised, you know, at middle age to undergo circumcision. There's no problem, but it's just not discussed. As Gary said, it's got great cultural connotations. It requires a debate on a very, without any value judgments, too many moral indicators coming in here. So I'm not sure. You're very right. I think the way it's being promoted, it's giving me a complex.
Gary, what I hear you saying is we should be engaging in that conversation. I don't hear you coming down one way or the other in relation to the actual, what you call technical intervention, but what you're saying is the larger context in which it may or may not be rolled out is a conversation that isn't going on.
I do have reservations about the act of circumcision. I mean, we do certain things in public health, and I said this the other morning in the circumcision session. We do know, for example, that quarantine is one of the ways in which we can deal with infectious diseases. But we deliberately went down the path of not using quarantine and opposing countries that tried it because we believed it had human rights consequences. Mm-hmm. So even if there is a kind of efficacy, that doesn't necessarily mean it should just be added willy-nilly to a pluralist arsenal. There are much larger questions involved about even if something is somewhat effective, we may not do it, or we may choose not to do it for certain reasons. So that's the debate that we also have to have. And the way the trials are set up, this sort of technology works. If it makes a contribution to reducing HIV, then it's just one of the arsenal. Well, no, that's not the case. It is much more complicated than that. Even if it works, we may choose not to do it on human rights grounds. And there's a series of other agendas here, the men's health agenda that's emerging around the world, which would have a very different theoretical take on this.
You know, we know that the cells inside the glands are susceptible to HIV. We also know that the cells inside a vagina are susceptible to HIV. But no one's talking about hysterectomies.
I just wanted to make a point of clarification about the... About the data that I presented on circumcision status and gay men. So everybody should be clear, right? There's been one trial looking at heterosexual acquisition for uninfected men with circumcision randomization for vaginal intercourse. Now, that study did assess MSM risks, but they were a very, very small number, so it couldn't say anything. The one study that's looked in a prospective fashion at all at circumcision status and HIV acquisition for gay men was in the context of the VaxGen HIV vaccine trial in multiple cities, right?
Yeah,
it's Susan's. Oh, it's Explore. Right, it's the Explore data. And there was an increased acquisition risk, so men were more likely to get HIV if they were uncircumcised. But that study was not set up to look at circumcision. It wasn't necessarily powered that way, and it really is an observational study. So it doesn't have the same level. I think it's important. This is the point I wanted to make. It doesn't have the same level as having had a successful intervention that was a clinical trial looking at a very much a biomedical model. So I would say that the data for this as a potential intervention for reducing risk of acquisition or transmission between men is weaker. We don't have an Orange Farm circumcision trial in MSM, and we should be clear about that.
But I want to reiterate, I still hear us all saying, I think we're unified in saying, the conversation should be happening.
Yeah.
We should be having this
absolutely.
Conversation.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm just trying to...
get it out there. Do you want to add something, Ken? Not too close here.
Yeah, that's right. Just building on Gary's point, I think, you know, the actual beginnings of the recognition of the epidemic among MSM helped facilitate a lot of discussion that had applicability to other groups. I think this is a venue, and AmFarm is a group that has the ability to disseminate information and to promote discussion. So Judy and Sonia AmFarm put together, or part of a group that's put together, this coalition for evidence-based prevention. And I think that we should scrutinize the data. As an infectious disease person, my bias is towards thinking this may be a good thing as part of a number of different approaches that can be at people's disposal, but I think Chris is completely correct in saying we cannot generalize from one study, one intervention in a heterosexual population, because the issues around what's the risk for the insertive partner may be very different for anal sex and certainly for the receptive partner. On the other hand, we don't want to ignore that data either. So yep. I think you're right. The rush to judgment has to be opposed. But I don't want us to say, non-specifically say gay community is leaving tonight saying, you know, circumcision can't have a role in HIV prevention in the future, depending on what the data show.
All right. We'll get some more questions in. Microphone one.
Mark Milano with Too Many Affiliations to List. I have a question about serosorting. The biggest change I've seen in my 25 years of having HIV is a huge increase in the number of HIV-negative men trying to serosort out positive partners, especially in the last 10 years. Especially men who want to bareback seem to be oftentimes incredibly concerned about avoiding HIV, and they do that by trying to screen out positive partners. And the biggest facilitator of this, in my experience, has been the internet. And for the speaker on the internet, most of the sites that have you, when you put up a profile, they require you to answer a question on your HIV status. I put a profile up, and I selected for HIV status, choose not to answer. And I got very few responses. I was kind of bummed out. So as a one-person clinical trial, I changed it to HIV negative. And suddenly, I got all these responses to my profile. It seems that it's very difficult to ask somebody in a bar or a bathhouse or whatever their HIV status. But when you are forced to answer on your profile on the internet, everybody assumes that someone who says positive or choose not to answer is positive. And so people who say negative, it's believed. If you say you're negative, you are negative. And could that be facilitating unsafe behavior on the internet? And should we be telling these sites, don't put that question up because it's giving people false reassurance of HIV status.
Yes, I agree. I think it varies from country to country. In the UK, they don't ask for HIV status. They ask about same-sex preferences, which is sort of always sometimes. You always prefer same-sex sometimes or never. And that has become a code. So depending on how you answer that, that can signify whether you're positive or think you're negative. But nonetheless, people are using that that information in the same way. I agree that serosorting among men whose last HIV test was negative, or the last HIV test was always negative, is in fact probably not an effective risk reduction strategy. We haven't found any increase in London among the number of HIV negative men who are reporting this, but there has been a report from Sydney that has shown an increase in the last few years, and possibly in other cities too. So I think it's something that seems to vary from country to country and city to city. But whereas serosorting, what we call serosorting among positive men, probably is an effective risk reduction strategy for HIV on the assumption that both men are positive and they are disclosing and being honest. Whereas with casual partners, HIV negative men cannot reliably make that assessment. What we did find, though, in London, in the UK study, was there was another group of men who were using the internet in a sort of filtering way, which was men who wanted to practice safe sex. That is, men who wanted to use condoms for anal intercourse, and they wanted to meet other men who wanted to use condoms for anal intercourse. So we tend to focus on men who are seeking unprotected sex, but there was also a substantial group of men who wanted protected sex, and they used the internet for filtering. So it is used in different ways, but I would agree with you that for men whose last HIV test result was negative and who are, as it were, serosorting for other negative casual partners, then this is, I think it's a rather sort of unwise risk reduction strategy at an individual level. And I think at a community level, as a public health intervention, it could facilitate HIV transmission rather than reducing it.
I just wanted to follow up with that. First of all, I think that a lot of gay men have been attempting to serosort since the beginning of the epidemic, or at least since the test became available. And it's really the research, serosorting is like one of the big buzzwords right now, and I think that a lot of people have been doing that for a long time. In the Explore data, when we looked at predictors of seroconversion, we found that regardless of what people said the status of their partner was, it was the number of partners. So, you know, at some point, so if you said your partner was HIV negative, if you went beyond a couple of partners, you were at a much higher risk of seroconverting. So at some point, you're going to guess wrong, or you're going to encounter someone who's actually positive. That person might not know it. So I think we really need to study it more before we endorse it wholeheartedly as a public health strategy.
Let's go to microphone two.
My question is for Grant. You talked about depression and instances of risky behavior, and I'm just wondering if you know of any studies similar to that, but looking at anxiety and sexual anxiety in particular.
Yeah, that's a good question. Gary Marks, who was the author of the meta-analysis that Jonathan covered, also did an analysis a couple of years ago on mental health states and HIV risk. And one of the things he looked at was anxiety. And he found in the meta-analysis that there wasn't a positive association between anxiety and sexual risk. There's a lot of heterogeneity out there in the studies, and you know, I think that again, as you try to measure anxiety, and it could be very situational and so forth. So I think it's still somewhat of an open question. But the review of the literature in 2001 with the meta-analysis did not show an association.
Steve Wakefield, I only have 7 questions, but since Kevin limited us, I want to ask each of you to respond briefly, what would you recommend as an intervention, since most of the early interventions came from gay men and the messages came from gay men? Is there a structural intervention or a message, something that we aren't including in our current messaging, that you would say is one thing that we should, as a community, be giving more attention in terms of providing harm reduction to MSM or gay men or whomever it is in your definition? But briefly, because most of you are really brilliant and you like to be thorough. So.
Who wants to go first? Which of you brainiacs are going to...
I would respond, I think one of the mistakes we make in public health is thinking that there's going to be one intervention to fit all these different communities, and I'd be happy to talk to you and all the other people, you know, about the different populations, but I think we really need to tailor different interventions. One size is not going to fit all, and I think that, you know, with HIV incidence rates so high among MSM communities across the world, we need to realize that and start addressing the risks that are really predicting the HIV seroconversion in those specific communities.
General agreement on that point, I think?
Probably
yeah.
Not.
Anybody
no.
else want to?
Chris, I guess I would just say, speaking specifically now to the developing country context, first things first. So while it's true that we need tailored interventions and we certainly need some new intervention approaches, it's also the case that, you know, we got plenty of places where the evidence suggests HIV is spreading and there's very little programming, there's very little surveillance, there's a very limited rights context, and there's harassment by police and state authorities of the very people who are trying to solve this problem. So those basic fundamentals, and you know, while it is hard to change individual behavior, state behavior really has to change as well to create an environment where just even the most basic kinds of education prevention can happen. And I think we're not there yet, so I would say first things first.
We're almost out of time, so I'm just going to take these last three questions who are at the microphones now, but we'll try to do it rather quickly. Microphone two.
Mike Kennedy from the Victorian AIDS Council Gay Men's Health Centre in Melbourne, Australia. My question's for Jonathan and for Gary. Seems to me that the surveying that's done of gay men is very much looking at individual behaviours. What did you do? What did you wear? Where did you put it? In terms of scaling up that we've been hearing about this year, this week, one of the things that it seems to me is looking at what's happening with gay men's social and sexual networks. And do either of you want to comment on the capacity that's there as an area to do some work that might inform our practice on the ground?
Very briefly. Here, Gary, see if they can pick you up from here.
I could only agree with you. In particular, when we look at the internet, we have to look at the place the internet is occupying in our lives, in everyone's lives. And therefore, although the data we've presented, it has been very much about sort of individual behaviours, we have also conducted qualitative research asking men about how they use the internet and where the internet fits in to their life on the bigger picture, if you wish, and we need to be able to combine that. So, in the limit, although one of the speakers very kindly said we were thorough, I think that's a euphemism for long-winded. But in the 15 minutes we were given, we could only limit ourselves to a certain amount of information. But in relation to the internet, it clearly has a context, and there is qualitative research that has been conducted in the UK and elsewhere that has placed the internet in that broader context, because I agree that in isolation I wouldn't say it's meaningless, but it is limited, and so I would agree with you, and that research is being done or has been done.
As a sociologist, I've always believed that behaviour change actually starts at a cultural level, not at an individual level. I don't believe the model that it comes from the individual and works its way up. I believe it goes the other way. And so I would always regard the place to aim the development of new interventions at a cultural level, and using sexual cultures as my conceptual way of doing that. Sexual networks is a version of that story, but it's not the same story. Might enable us to focus in a quite different way from working our way up from the idea that what we try and do is change individual behaviours rather than the sexual cultures in which those behaviours are embedded. That's where I would keep working.
Microphone one, please try to be very brief.
Harla Dillard-Smith, CalPEP, Oakland, California. Now that we have the prevalence information on black men on the down low, what happens next? That's my question.
Well, I think when you think about the risks that clearly where there's evidence to say this is causal, in other words, this is part of the causal pathway. So the syphilis epidemic clearly is causal. There's enough evidence to say that old association is there. And in fact, if you look, there's a recent MMWR on syphilis in the United States, and the gender ratio of syphilis is roughly 1-1 in most racial categories, but in blacks it's diverging to about 4-1. So the syphilis epidemic is really male, and it's really MSM in African Americans. So that's a target that really needs to be focused on. I think secondly, the data that suggests that this low access, low frequency of testing and the very high proportion of African Americans who don't know their status means that we're not getting VCT and the counseling and services that go with it to that population. I think that has to be a targeted intervention. It's got to get out there. And I think it has to be a community intervention. There's got to be sort of more engagement and embrace of that. Neither of those things are magic bullets. The other two areas where we think the data suggests there's something to do is the sexual networks, so that really refers to what Gary is saying. And the other is incarceration. There's been this one positive study. We need more data on that, but it is clear incarceration probably is an HIV risk for everybody, but it is disproportionately so for African-American men. And that's one, I think, that it's tough to say that we working in HIV have to change that, but America has to change that.
Yes, hi, Michael Callen from New York City. I'm so cold I can't even think. I wanted to just thank you all. I thought the presentations were uniformly excellent. And I especially wanted to thank Gary for his gratuitous nudity at the end there. And I see that actually with some seriousness, because I'm really actually amazed at the almost total lack of any sex-positive imagery at this entire conference. I think it speaks to an underlying theme about shame around sex in general that is still so prevalent, and it's sort of the topic that dare not, be named. And I think to that point, there's almost this assumption now, and we're hearing a lot of very well-deserved discussion around stigma and discrimination and certainly criminalization of male-male sex. But there's this underlying idea that if you took away all those things, that everything would just be just fine. And I just wonder, maybe not so much to answer since we're over time now, but in terms of the work you're doing, whether or not you're considering and looking at the issue of shame in men around, same sex, and what kind of a role, if any, that plays in contributing to high-risk behavior and or guilt associated with engaging in high-risk behavior and how that perpetuates this whole negative self-image.
Go ahead, Gary.
I've forgotten the name of the bloke. The bloke who wrote a book called The Trouble with Normal, Michael Warner. Yeah, Michael Warner's book, The Trouble with Normal. He makes a distinction between stigma and shame, and says that really what we've been doing in the way we work on both gay politics and AIDS in the Western world has we've been working on stigma, we haven't worked on shame. And that shame is much harder to deal with in relation to sex. And I think it's a worthwhile point to explore. And he does do that in the first part of that book. So I'd recommend, as I said, The Trouble with Normal, to have a read of this sort of thing. I think it's a very difficult... I just come back from living in the States for a couple of years. I think it's incredibly difficult in the United States to talk about pleasure and sex. In a country that makes movies about pleasure and sex all the time, it is almost impossible to have a face-to-face conversation in a meeting of professionals about pleasure and sex. And indeed, I mean, just to my colleagues up here, we only generally talk about negative affect in relation to sex. We never really go out and research positive affect in relation to sex. We don't really have pleasure scales. We do depression scales, but we don't put pleasure scales in our studies. And to think about, and in fact, my colleagues and I that are working on the barebacking projects in New York are literally having to debate this point because we're getting a lot of positive affect. Surprise, surprise. So I really think that we have to, this is where again I'd come back to culture, because gay men's sexual culture is in fact full of positive stuff about sex. But we tend to have turned that as a strategy of prevention we used in the 80s and into the 90s as we became more and more convinced about individual generic behaviour change models as a way to work. We kind of lost the capacity to bring our own pleasure and our own lack of shame, our complete capacity to be beyond the pale when it comes to pleasure or sex, and bring that into our prevention activities. We've kind of become clinical in a way that I think is not even belonging to our own culture. I want to re-gayify prevention. I want to get the bodies back in there myself. I want us to get away from generic models and go back to culturally driven models of prevention using what we've learnt, because we have lost the capacity to do that at the moment, and one of the ways to do that is to be sex positive.
And that's all the time for Sex Positive we have tonight. Thank you all for being here, and thank our panel.
Oh.